This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Oh, here we go. It's another week in the trial of Karen Reed, and we're going to break it down where things are at as of this recording, where things might be going, where things have went, what damage has been done, what non-damage has been done thus far. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, here to join us. But before we get into the conversation, of course, we have to thank today's sponsor of the show, Karen Reed Vodka. Karen Reed Vodka, where memory fails, confidence prevails. KR Vodka. Got to get yourself a nice bottle of that, before the day starts. Take a nice little shot in the morning, and the day's going to be good. So, Jennifer.
Yes.
There's been a lot this last week in the trial. I think the thing that stood out to me most was the clip, the unedited long form clip, which I found interesting from the ID docuseries. And this thing wasn't even aired in its entirety. It was only aired in the trial, which makes me wonder, what else are we going to see here that didn't make the air from the cutting room floor? With her going on, making about a 5 to 7 minute explanation of how many drinks she had that night, which of course that's not a healthy relationship with alcohol when you're taking 5 to 7 minutes to explain how many drinks you had. That should be a quick answer. How much damage do you think that did? Doesn't show that she's a killer, but it shows not the best judgment.
Yeah, you know, Tony, this is really important to show motive, if you will. Mm-hmm. Not exactly the motive, but what caused her to take the leap from just being angry to taking action. Mm-hmm. And when individuals see that somebody is that drunk, right? Because mm-hmm. we also got the information regarding her blood alcohol level mm-hmm. hours later and her explanation of her drinking issues. When you put that all together, it shows somebody letting down their guard, right? Not mm-hmm. having the inhibitions they might normally have, by her own admissions, having issues with memory and such. So it just totally, in my opinion, ruined her credibility.
I was shocked by it, and the fact that she even said these things out loud. I mean, it to me, it shows a lot of denial of reality. Again, doesn't show that she killed John O'Keefe, but it shows that she has a real hard time dealing with the real world, what the consequences are for your actions, and believing she can kind of talk her way out of it, which it seems like she was trying to do in that interview. And denial's not a good thing you want to be known for when you're being accused of murdering someone.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I mean, just to listen to her try to explain, if you will, why a drink isn't a drink. It's not a drink, and if it's not a good drink, you just need to pour a shot in it, mm-hmm. and that will make it an average drink. And for her not to understand that's an issue, and it's not like she did it once, Tony. She
no.
talks about it multiple times and then doing shots. I think the CW has her at 9 mm-hmm. in an hour and 45 minutes, something like that. I think she put herself at 7. Depending on which interview you listen to.
Yes.
No matter what, she's a small woman. I just can't imagine most people would just have severe alcohol poisoning. But of course, when you have a buildup, right, mm-hmm. and you can deal with drinking more alcohol because you drink all the time, you have a tolerance. And that was also made very clear.
Yeah, I'm going to go with very high tolerance on that. What the hell was going on with her attorneys that they said, you can do this. Go ahead. Go talk. And no one is stopping her. I mean, that to me is just the biggest blow your mind moment of all of this. Like, what is going on behind the scenes? I mean, did they just say, yeah, go ahead. Go do your interviews. We're going to stay back here at the office. And even some of the interviews, they're right next to her and they're letting her go on and on and on. What did they think they had to gain out of any of this? None of this needed to be part of this trial, but they created so many problems for themselves. I am baffled by these attorneys.
Well, this is what I think. I think, first of all, that was filmed well over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I say well over a year ago, approximately a year ago. And yeah. I think they thought she would be acquitted.
What an assumption.
By the time they got it done and got it done, I think they, you know, if you play craps, they bet the cum.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out for them.
Wow. I mean, what a dumb move, especially for experienced attorneys. I mean, these guys aren't like Saul Goodman operating out of the end of a mini mall. These are experienced, well-paid, you know, well-educated people who've been through a case or two, who know how to argue a case or two. What a stupid bet to make. Now where we see them in court with her and they're playing these clips back, what the hell do you think is going through their minds?
Well, I don't know if you caught it, but on the clip, I think where she describes hitting him mm-hmm. and that he wasn't mortally wounded.
Yeah.
I think it was that clip. You can just see her face is absolutely empty, mm-hmm. meaning, you know, you can just see how upset she is. And Jackson whispers not once, but twice in her ear. And the look on his face, like, you idiot. That's yeah. what I gleaned from it. You'll have to watch it. It's very interesting because Jackson has a lot of expression in his face. And so does Karen Reed. They mm-hmm. just can't help it. They're very expressive people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll have to let me know what you think, but it was just like, what an idiot.
Are you talking about the Dateline interview, the Dennis Murphy? Because I didn't see Jackson on that one, but you're talking about a different one. Because I can't picture the one where Jackson's in it.
Well, no, he's not in it.
Okay.
But they clipped to him in trial.
You're right. Yes, you're right. They did. Yeah, I will. Let me show it right here. This is, and it doesn't have him in it, but this is just the Dennis Murphy comment. Or wait, when she's with Dennis Murphy. Let's play this, and I want to talk about it on the other side.
He didn't look mortally wounded as far as I could see, but could I have done something that knocked him out and in his drunkenness and in the cold didn't come to again?
And this would have been the moment you dropped him off at the party.
Yeah,
thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, in trial. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Now that came to me. That in itself, right there, he didn't look mortally wounded. They led with that clip, which I thought was pretty good, and I'm sure we're going to see it again. I'm curious if Dateline provided more raw material. I know ID did. I don't know if Dateline did. But, my God, that right there, I mean, she goes from, you know, conjecture and hyperbole of, you know, could I, to an absolute statement. He didn't look mortally wounded when I left him. And I know they're now trying to argue, her defense is trying to argue, that was when you saw him at night, right, Karen? Like that was, or in the morning when you got there, right, Karen? Clearly, it was not that point in time. I mean, it's spelled out.
Two again.
And this would have been the moment you dropped him off at the party.
Yeah,
thinking.
Yeah.
It's right there.
He didn't look mortally.
Right there, saying this is the moment you dropped him off at the party. How are they even arguing that? Because it's right there in the clip, like the next line.
Well, Aaron, you know, Alan Jackson is very good of really making what I call spaghetti mm-hmm. out of people's words. You know, it
yeah.
just is a pile, and even though they're being honest and truthful, he gets them all mixed up and wrapped up. He can't do that with these mm-hmm. clips. Because
no.
the clips speak for themselves, but yet he's trying to. And it's kind of humorous because he's hoping that by the power of suggestion, he can convince people, and it's not working.
Well, and it's being presented to the jury. It's not like the jury didn't see the Dennis Murphy response either, and her response too. To me, it's another line where it's going down this road of you are only hurting your credibility, because if people start, you're literally lying about what somebody just watched with their own eyes. It's not like it's up for debate. That clip is not up for debate about when she was talking about what she was talking about. It's just, it's not, it's a fact. There it is in her own words. But to go and try and tell a jury or the public, no, that's not what you just saw. then what else are you lying about? Because we haven't even gotten to that yet. We haven't gotten to the story of the house and the dog and everybody and their brother and their cousin. And the first responders are all in on this big lie. It's just kind of baffling how far they think, or he thinks, that he can, you know, mislead a jury.
Well, Tony, though, you're being logical.
Yeah.
And he is hoping that individuals will listen to him and take his word as testimony mm-hmm. and as evidence and as statements, even though they're going to be told not to do that. They do. Mm-hmm. And you can see it when you're on social media.
Yeah.
But Alan Jackson said this. Well, Alan Jackson said that as if it's evidence and mm-hmm. facts, and that isn't how it's supposed to work. But he knows that he's dealing likely with some of those in the jury box that might not understand that.
Yeah.
And the beauty is these clips are going back with them. Mm-hmm. They're in evidence. It's not like they just got to listen to them. They can play them over and over and over again. And I think that's going to be helpful for the prosecution.
Let's play the drinking clip. This is the long one. This is from court the other day. The audio is not super wonderful, but it is what it is. Let's take a look here at exactly what they, Karen's own words about the night with drinking.
The final count suffered. The final count of my alcohol intakes, probably about 5 or 6 or 4. The drinks that they were pouring me at McCarthy's, which is where I consumed most of the alcohol, was the weakest vodka tonic. It tasted just like old soda water with lime. Not that I needed it to be a martini, but it might have had a splash of vodka in it. So John, I said, John, this drink tastes like it has no vodka in it. He said, just get a shot and mix it yourself. So each drink was being counted as a double. So I would get a vodka tonic, and then I would pour a shot into it, so that would come as two. Frankly, it just felt like a regular cocktail. It was just a really weak pour, so I asked for a shot.
She already contradicts herself in this damn thing. So it tasted like a regular cocktail. A regular weak cocktail. You mean a normal cocktail, Karen? You're not a double? Just a normal, like that's what is called a cocktail. And you can get a double if you want. But I guess it works out easier in her mind if she pours the shot herself. And I'm going to guess this is something that's, you know, just the level of comfort that she has talking about this. I'm guessing this is not the first time something like this has happened where it's like, let's get an extra shot to pour in the drink.
Oh, I agree. I mean, you can tell how she speaks of alcohol. It's just pretty unusual. And for those of us who have dealt with individuals, friends, or family members that have issues with alcohol, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm listening to same song, second verse from mm-hmm. things I've heard from them.
Yeah. No, I mean, just somebody going on and on and on and on, trying to figure out how to explain something. That should literally take about 5 seconds. I had X amount of drinks that night. But we continue with this.
So, for my taste, it just tasted like that's the normal strength of what a drink should be. So, I had maybe 2 or 3 that are being counted as 4 and 6. And, I don't know. I felt fine. I felt like I was buzzed. And then there was one drink, the last one that was given to me, which I would have counted as 3. They're counting as my 6th cocktail. The guys that we were with bought a round of shots, and they gave me one that I didn't drink, but I poured it in my drink. So that's now my 5th and 6th drinks, with the 7th, which is a shot that all the men did, and I poured it. So that one glass that I'm holding that I go into the waterfall with has 3 drinks in it, a vodka tonic and 2 shots. And which is why John said to me, you're not leaving that drink here. Like, you haven't touched it and just poured a bunch of wine. He's like, just take it with you, which was something he always did.
So something he always did. I like that too.
And I put that drink
steal the glass with the drink
most of the time. So that would have been my 5th, 6th, and 7th drinks. Then John orders me a drink at the waterfall that I don't drink, that he takes with him. And then there was a round of shots that Chris Oliver bought that I did take. So that would have been the night. But I did not consume 9 vodka martinis or take 9 shots, depending on how you count it. And the last 2 drinks, I didn't touch.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
It's like SNL. I mean, it feels like a bit. It does. I don't even know what to make of all that. Every time I watch it, I'm picking out something new, and I'm just like, did she just say that? The rationalization in all of this. And she speaks of it, and I noticed this too. She's got that big smile on her face when she's talking about all this. And it's like, look, this is probably like the catalyst of what ruined your life. And you talk about alcohol like it's some lover of yours. Like, I just did this, and it's this, and it's a good to me. It's like talking about like an abusive relationship, but you love your abuser to such an insane point, and it's booze. It's just so bizarre.
It is, Tony. You know, when I first heard that clip, actually, it just makes your head spin.
Yeah.
You almost can't listen to it all because it's just, you know, her trying to rationalize.
Mm-hmm.
But Tony, you know, when you look at everything, this is just one small part of the many lies she told on social media. And they are brilliantly putting them up in piecemeal to drive home a point made by the witness in advance of the clip. I love the order of proof they're going in, and I like how they put the punch in it with her Karen at the end of each one.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I think, a very smart way of presenting this case, because you get out there, you bring your witnesses up, you got Cross, then you can accent everything with a little clip at the end that pretty much contradicts everything. that the point was when the Cross goes on to the witnesses with Karen's own words. And I can't, gosh, I wonder how many of these clips, I mean, I know they all have to have seen them already, but how many they're just like, please don't show that one. Please don't show that one. And boom, there it is. There it is.
Yeah. No, it's funny. There's a funny scene in the movie Beaches. I don't know if you've ever seen it, with Bette Midler, and she's watching television, and she just did an interview, and she says, oh no, please don't say that. Oh no, you're good. You're right. She knows she said it.
Yeah.
Oh, you said it. And you just wonder how many times they're having those moments. Please don't play that one. Oh geez.
Oh my
and
God.
There's nothing they can do. But I also wonder, Tony, did her, as you said, very experienced prosecution team allow this because of Sixth Amendment issues later on, on appeal, if she's convicted?
Mm-hmm.
So you're, like I said, playing the come one way, saying, okay, that she's probably going to be acquitted in their minds. And then secondarily, if she's convicted, don't worry, Karen, guess what? You're going to have this as an appealable argument. I've heard it's not appealable if both parties, in other words, if she says, no, it's fine, which she did, and I don't care about my privilege anymore, which is the whole reason these are allowed to be played.
Yeah.
Just such a huge tactical error. And you just wonder, were they trying to get to the jury pool by making this a big media stance and having just one juror feel sorry for her?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do wonder about that. I mean, you had 12 jurors on there, you know, more if you're counting the alternates. I'm going to guess one of them has a drinking problem, just sheer numbers, just odds, or has experienced one or has someone that's been close to them where they might have a little sympathy for Karen in some of this. Again, it looks horrible. It clearly shows someone that, and I'm sorry to laugh about it in all reality, because seriously, that's a big problem. It can ruin lives. Obviously, it has here. But at the same point, it's been comical to watch this, because the justification is outrageous. But it doesn't show that she killed John O'Keefe. It shows she makes really bad decisions. But I'm wondering if they're kind of going to try and lean into this and go, yes, you saw these clips at the end. You saw these thoughts that she had. none of it shows that she willingly decided to kill her boyfriend. But it does show that she, you know, she doesn't make a lot of great choices. She obviously, by the time everybody watches the excuses of where she was or what happened when she let him out of the car that night, the seven different versions of it, they may go, she has no idea what happened that night, and not go, oh, I believe this version or that version, but she has no idea what occurred there. So it certainly leans more towards manslaughter, possibly, but even that, I think, can be kind of a stretch. How do you think they're going to connect all this to second-degree murder?
Well, I think how they connect it is going forward and then slamming it into reverse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just a big, big issue. There's no reason to reverse. You're leaving at that point. There's just no reason. And that's where you say she made a cognizant effort to throw it into reverse, to press that pedal, and to move the vehicle in his direction. And remember, in second degree, you just have to make the point, should a logical person essentially know that if they hit somebody with a car, they should die.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's, you know, this planned out, mm-hmm. well-intentioned, which some will argue that. And does the alcohol intake mitigate that? I think it fueled it.
Yeah.
And perhaps it does mitigate it. And maybe, you know, the jury will only entertain count two.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see. I think there's just nuances with the murder two that doesn't make it seem like people understand it.
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't have to be intentional. You just have to understand that such an act could kill somebody.
Mm-hmm. But did she understand that at that moment? Was she even thinking that at that moment? I mean, because when I think about the throwing it into reverse, what I think about is not, you know, F him, I'm going to gun it back at him. I think they're arguing. And another thing, and she throws it back because she thinks that he'll hear her better, you know, that sort of a thing where somebody's walking out of the room and they come back, but she's in a vehicle, so she reversed. I don't know how you're going to prove that in her mind she was like, okay, if I reverse here really fast, I could potentially kill John. I don't think that was even in her head. I think it was just, I'm going to tell him one more thing. And then judging by the voicemails after, that seemed to be the mood that she was in. How are they going to get from there to there? Because you're really trying to prove something in someone's mind who's already, you know, three sheets to the wind or seven or nine, depending on how you do Karen drink math. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you're going to show that, because clearly she was devastated once she found out he was dead. It wasn't a, oh, shucks. I mean, that kind of seems like what it was a bit after the fact when the attention got onto her. But that day, you know, she ended up being in a psych ward.
Yeah, no, that's true. But when you look at her backing up, as I said, mm-hmm. it's an intentional action.
Yeah.
And I get your point. Did she intentionally just go back and maybe want to open her window and scream at him some more? But those voice messages,
yeah.
her words are not at all slurred.
No, they're not.
She's able to drive. We're not getting any information. Ian Whiffen, I was just listening to him describe the entire journey from the bar to the house based on the cell mm-hmm. information, which is so reliable. And I bet it's going to match up for the most part with the vehicle data, mm-hmm. right? It might be off a minute or a few seconds, but it's going to be pretty reliable.
Yeah.
And there's nothing about her swerving. You know, I was listening to it. In other words, that cell phone is going in a direct direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see if that vehicle data matches up. Again, high tolerance, able to drive, not slurring her words, cognizantly available during mm-hmm. that time. And if you look also at her very specific recollections, oh, I was listening to, what was it, YouTube?
I thought YouTube at first, but I think she was saying YouTube, the band. That's what I got. I'm like, why would she be listening to YouTube? Oh, YouTube. Okay. So with or without you, she's jamming. With or without you. And one more thing, John.
Oh my gosh, you picked that song. That's so funny.
Oh.
Which is a good song. But nevertheless, she remembers all these details, although I will say it depends on which version. I've heard about six versions now, and they're all different.
Yeah. The vehicle data is fascinating, and I know they're talking about it literally as we're talking here. I don't know if we're going to see this or not, but I mean, these vehicles, they have incredible, you know, sensors on them. It'll beep at you if a squirrel runs too close sometimes. Are we going to see anything on this vehicle data that we did not see last time that shows any sort of strike to the vehicle? I would think that if there's data, maybe that would be there. I don't know.
Oh, we are. I think this time.
Yeah.
Remember the first time they did not have the person who evaluated it.
Mm-hmm.
While they were an overall expert, they weren't an expert specifically on the Lexus.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to call it the black box, that vehicle information. And we're being told, oh, they have so much more information that they've gleaned. And there was something that I saw in Alan Jackson's opening statement, where he says they both got out of the vehicle. And I thought that was very interesting. It was the first time I heard it. Some people are saying, oh, it was a slip. He was just talking and he didn't mean to say they got out of the vehicle.
Yeah.
But Alan Jackson doesn't normally slip on something as important as that detail.
Yeah.
He certainly doesn't allow his witnesses to slip on anything that when they speak. But my point was, does he know something we don't in terms of did her door ever open? So I'm really watching intently because we know Brennan has kept a lot secret, right? That he's throwing in there that we haven't seen before. And I keep wondering, wow, did she get out after the strike? If she got out after the strike and that door opened, to me, it's a game over situation. It's, you know, just drop the mic. It's the linchpin because that would show it would match up with her words about he didn't look mortally wounded. I don't know if that happened.
Yeah.
All I can tell you is what Alan Jackson said.
That would be, that would be the end of it because that's where you get second degree, where if she realizes that she hit him, and that's where the mortally wounded line comes in, didn't look mortally wounded. That would tell you that she did see him on the ground or something, maybe stumbling around and thinking, oh, he's fine. That shows she was conscious of his state of being after something happened to him. Maybe she didn't know what happened to him. Maybe she thought he slipped. Maybe he did slip. Maybe that is what happened. And she saw him kind of stumbling around, but thought, oh, he's drunk. He didn't look mortally wounded. He's going to get in the house, and she leaves. That along with the vehicle data that's going to show timestamps, because we have various, you know, accounts from Karen of sitting there for, you know, 2 minutes, 10 minutes, all different time windows. It's going to contradict because it can't be all of them at once.
Yeah, she's contradicted herself, but the jury hasn't seen all the contradictions yet.
Yeah.
But the minute that vehicle data comes in, I think they will play a clip of her contradicting herself. I would expect that to happen.
Yeah.
Also, Tony, on that vehicle data, did she go back? Remember, that was basically indicated, but they didn't have that vehicle proof. If they've been able to delve further into that box, did she ever go back in? Because why would she tell Kerry Roberts he's dead?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, unless it's just that frantic. I mean, because I can see both things on that. If you're still drunk, because she was. With the high tolerance and you're freaking out and you don't know where your significant other is. I mean, I can get where you're going to say every variation of what the worst case scenario could be, where you catastrophize it, you know, he's dead. He could be dead. I wonder if, all of it, because I'm sure it's all come out. So I can get where those statements are being made and they're not necessarily a confession, but they're certainly possible consciousness of guilt or just paranoia of what possibly could have happened to him when you're running every scenario through your mind. But if you saw him get into the house, which she claims she did, why would you have those thoughts?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You would never think that if truly, as in one version, She said she saw him sneak his head in the, you know, like a raccoon.
Yeah.
She pointed out, peek around the window frame.
Yeah.
Why, or the door frame, why in the world would she be checking or even think that she could have hit him? That's why I say she knows what happened
That's,
for all those reasons.
That's very true, because when you look at it in hindsight, you always got to look at, okay, what happened at what point? And the fact that she's freaking out, John's not answering his phone, they've been drinking all night, and it's still very early in the morning. A lot of times when people drink, they sleep in a bit because they're trying to sleep off the booze. I think I'd be thinking he's probably on, you know, somebody's couch somewhere or wherever, not home. Nobody, because I'd be thinking, well, nobody was sober enough to drive him home. So he slept on the Albert's couch or whatever it may be. You wouldn't naturally go to, he's dead. You wouldn't naturally go to, let's go check the front lawn. That would be the last thing on your mind at that moment in time, unless you know he's in the front lawn. and you didn't see him go in the house.
And I'm going to take it a step further.
Yeah.
If you think you hit him and killed him, if you think that's a possibility and he could be on the front lawn, why in the world would you call two people you don't know?
Yeah.
That are friends of the victim? It's because you want an alibi that doesn't look like a friend giving you one.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't even have their numbers, Tony.
Yeah.
She had to confer with the niece. She had to get the niece to call.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you call them and say, come pick me up? I think John's dead, essentially. We got to go look for him.
Yeah.
I think it was such a well-played and well-planned, now I've got these two girls on the hook so I can do the acting scene. And I'm not saying it was entirely an act, but the frantic scene of finding him, because she knew she couldn't do it on her own.
Mm-hmm.
Normally a person, if they, you know, first of all, there was nothing she did normal as a person, you know, drop him off. If he goes to the party, you know, and he's not answering later, you call those people, you reach out to somebody who knows them.
Yeah.
I mean, these are 40-year-old people. This is not like teenagers. They should know how to react. And you might go over to that house and knock on the door and say, hey, listen, did John spend the night last night? Because we know how she is after seeing all her text messages, right?
Yeah.
That might not be a normal, but what is totally unusual is called two people you don't know.
That's, and you're exactly right. Why did she not? They pull into the house. Look, you're not going to see the body in the front yard. That's anybody who's lived in snowy environments and knows how that works. A body, you know, yay big, flat on the ground, and there's, you know, many inches of snow, you're barely going to see a bump, if anything, especially if it's blowing and windy and you got drifts and stuff going on. There may be no bump at all. And to make your first move, to run through the yard to a spot that nobody else sees anything because it's covered in snow, and not go to that front door, not to go, is John in here? I'm really worried, you know, because again, I think you'd be thinking he's on someone's couch, not passed out or dead, you know, over by the flagpole. That would not be your natural point of reference or thought to go to unless you know something is there.
You're so right, Tony. It's all Occam's razor.
Yeah.
It's what all makes the logical sense. The most obvious is typically where the investigation goes. It's not always, but it certainly is in this case.
Yeah.
And it's all the pieces. Look at all the pieces we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All the actions. And we haven't even talked about the fact that when she arrived back at John's house, that Ring camera footage is mysteriously gone. And guess who had the ability to erase it?
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Reed. She ran in, and at least according to the testimony, no, she didn't run over to the kids that she had been helping care for. She didn't run over to anybody. She ran upstairs and got her things and was gone very quickly.
Mm-hmm. There's, yeah, There's so much here. What do you think of the field trip that they took the other day to the scene? Obviously, you know, it's, you know, getting into summer or it's late spring and not at all what it would have felt like on that morning. But you get to see the distance from the house and where the road is and where everything is. What do you think the jury gleaned from that visit?
Well, you know, to me, the biggest thing is the driveway. The driveway, as you're looking at the house, is at the far right side of that house. And if you're exiting that middle door, which is where everybody went in and out of, and you're going on the sidewalk and you're headed towards your cars, there'd be no reason ever to look back over to the right, the far right, especially in the dark, freezing cold, if they're keeping that into account, the temperatures. I didn't hear at this trial. We'll see if they get somebody on to talk about how slippery and icy the sidewalk was. So people were actually looking down to keep their footing when they exited the porch area. I hope they touch on that. I think that's really important. The other thing is they're going to be able to see the vantage point from that middle door over to the lawn, and from the lawn over to the middle door. You can't see anything that way. Even if you walked out, the first thing you decided to do was stare to the right. You're not going to be able to see.
Then also, do you think it showed anything in terms of, I mean, because there's kind of a little bit of a slope there, it looks like, in terms of, you know, how that would have worked, where his head would have been to possibly make contact with her taillight, if that's indeed what happened? Do you think that the jury gleaned anything out of that?
Well, I think they did, because this time, as opposed to last trial, they parked that Lexus in the spot essentially where Karen Reed parked. You know, last time they kept it up at another location closer to the driveway, as I recall. I think that's helpful to the prosecution. The big thing helpful to the defense is the fact it's not dark, there's no elements, and there's no snow. Even the plowing effects of, you know, that's why his shoe wasn't found. I mean, it was under so much snow. Carrie Roberts testified she didn't even know who it was. The until she dug and uncovered that face, it was inches of snow. I just hope the prosecution really drives some of these points home.
I think they're doing a good job so far. It's going to be interesting. I'm not counting out Karen Reed's defense, because they are good. They've just been, I think they got dealt a horrible hand this time because of everything that Karen did. It's like they're playing blackjack and she went and brought Uno cards into the game. Like, what the hell is this? I play Uno. I had five drinks, but I put a shot in every other one, and I brought Uno cards to mix in with the deck. Isn't this great? Like, what the hell? Peggy O'Keefe, she made her statements this recently in court, and I guess what I was kind of taken aback by, and I didn't know the dynamics of the relationships here, but her son had been with Karen Reed for 2 years, and her reaction is like, why is she here? That's cold. But probably for a reason. I'm not faulting Peggy O'Keefe, but I'm like, that's an interesting take, because if I was with someone for 2 years and, you know, they died tragically, you know, and the family's not, you know, thinking it's you yet, you'd think, you know, oh, you know, they'd be right there with the family mourning. But it was more like, what is that bitch here for?
Well, it was. And I tell you, there's something to be said for a mother's intuition. And women, I will say, women know women. It takes me about 10 seconds, maybe a little bit longer, a few minutes for the most part to get a read on somebody. No pun intended. And, you know, particularly women to women. I don't know about men to women. I think women can seemingly beguile men all day long for years sometimes.
You're all good at that.
That's what I've seen. I call it the 3-year rule. And I always say a woman can be pretty fake, but at about the 3rd year mark, you start seeing the true them for those that don't want to see it. And I wondered by her statement, I thought, well, first of all, I think the reason there's so much ire in her voice on that stand is she is literally looking at the woman and saying the name of the woman and hearing about the woman that took her son's life in this disgusting way.
Yeah.
Not only did, in Peggy O'Keefe's mind, not only did she slam into him, crack his skull open, and leave him to slowly, at least to some degree, because they said hypothermia was an element, mm-hmm. just freeze to death with their brain being overcome with blood. I mean, I would be so angry too.
Yeah.
I would be just beside myself. And you could see that and feel that ire. But I understand that the statement she says was early.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, maybe Peggy had her pegged before others did.
Yeah. I mean, I'm gonna guess a lot of people had her pegged. And that's, you know, why things kind of played out some of the way they did, with people being human, not great reactions, especially when you get into Proctor territory. But I mean, when you see and you hear the things that like Proctor said and the way that this was all being handled, I'm going to guess, you know, he heard from plenty of John's friends about the relationship about to be done. And I'm going to guess, you know, O'Keefe had told a lot of his buddies, you know, horror stories that we don't even know about from that relationship, and probably pretty vile, selfish things. I mean, this is just my guess, where one would go, oh my God, like, why are you with that monster? I mean, just judging by the dynamics with the kids and the way that she's trying to spin things as her being the hero now, I'm going to guess it was kind of dark. And so I get to a certain extent where you're going to have that reaction of like, my God, yeah, like she's going to fry or whatever. But you can't do that when you're a cop. And especially when you're the lead investigator, why would you not recuse yourself there? I mean, that part right there is still, and they got to bring all that to the table. We have not heard the Proctor everything yet, and I'm sure it's going to be an extravaganza of a week of that. How are they going to counter all of that? We're seeing a lot of bad character information on Karen right now, but you still got Proctor coming. How damaging do you think that will be?
It's going to be damning. I mean, and this is why the prosecution, I love how they're doing it this year. They are getting ahead of Proctor this time by saying they want to paint the picture that Proctor talked about.
Yeah.
Right? They're trying to say, look at the lies. Look at how she mocked the mother of the decedent. Well, which again, that was a consciousness of guilt. If you believe Peggy O'Keefe, who said, I never sat at the counter, I was never in the kitchen, and I never told Karen Reed anything. And actually, from what she said, what's she doing here? That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
She just stayed far away from her, especially if she had any inkling that she did do it. But that's why that clip got in. I've been asked that a lot. How could legally that clip get in? It shows consciousness of guilt. It shows her reflecting what she thought everybody was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
She says it about, but puts it in Peggy O'Keefe's mouth. And that's why that got in. And that's super damning, I think, to see her face. And so I think that they are setting up why Proctor thought that way. I'm not saying it's right in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying, will some of those jury members think to themselves, wow, she was that X, Y, or Z? Not that it's right.
Yeah.
But that's what they're trying to paint.
It's like, is it going to land, I guess? Because that's a risky shot right there too. I mean, but you have nothing to lose. I mean, the clips can only help you. But I hear what you're saying, where it's not going to make it right, but on a human standpoint, let's say Proctor wasn't a cop. Let's say these people who are making these comments, you know, were just, you know, friends of John O'Keefe or something. People would talk like that. Humans would talk like that of like, yeah, she's going to go down. You know, my God, look at the, you know, these horrible stories we've heard of how she was treating him. Yeah. You know, she's going to go down. Not because someone's going to try and lie about her or make up some other story, but just, you know, she did this, and she's as reckless there as she was with his feelings when he was alive. That would be, I mean, it's a human response. Again, not saying it's right by any means, but you're really trying to make this land in a kind of a dark area where I don't think a lot of people would admit they would think or be. But I think a lot of us would if you heard those sort of things from John about his girlfriend.
Well, they're going to point out that he was talking to his besties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was talking to his high school buddies. That they're in a group string and to the sister. And does that make it right? No, but it makes him human, right? Those were his reflections that he's talking to his buddies about. You're never supposed to talk about a case to anybody outside of, you know, your local, your law enforcement, your fellow law enforcement, or judges or prosecutors.
Yeah.
So, and he's been fired over it.
Sure.
And I've said, I think that helps the prosecution. It's not like they just let him get away with a slap on the wrist. He's done his long career that by all accounts, he was very successful and awarded for doing good for years without any slips. And
or he got away with a lot of shit for years.
He did.
One of the two. I'm going to go with more so got away with things for a long time.
Yeah. But just got away, which I agree with you, likely, right? They found it. They found that he was drinking on the job.
Yeah.
I mean, this community, I just don't get it. everybody in this circle seems to be constantly drinking.
Yeah.
But I mean, a cop that can't even control his drinking, not to drink on the job and not to drink in the cruiser.
The thing, I mean, I grew up in Wisconsin, which is like the most alcoholic state in the country. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like Wisconsin and Canton. I mean, it really, cause look, I mean, I grew up with a culture like this where it's like, they drink for everything. They drink at church picnics. They, you know, the kids are in the bounce house and dad's pounding away five or six or an extra shot or two. But if you count it this way, it's really only two or three beers, but they were trying to say it's this and you get out of the bounce house. Dad, can we go play the fishing game? He's like, oh, I got to put an extra shot in this drink first. And it's being poured by the nuns. That is kind of Wisconsin.
So funny.
It's nuts. Let's watch that clip quick of Peggy
and
of
his
Karen.
His mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, "I think it looks like you got hit by a car. It looks like you got hit by a car." I'm like, "Wait a minute. Were you both looking at the same body?"
Yeah, they were, Karen. They were looking at the same body. And another reason why Alan Jackson's argument of she was talking about the morning. He did look mortally wounded the next morning. If you looked at John O'Keefe that morning, you go mortally wounded. You wouldn't be like, he didn't look mortally wounded. That would also make zero sense.
Absolutely. She was hysterical.
Yeah.
She thought he looked mortally wounded because he was completely buried and was an Iceman.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't even see his face. You couldn't see his body. She had to scrape that off and then laid herself on top of him. So, and she was, you know, screaming to, or at least telling Jen McCabe to Google, you know, how long can you survive? What? And then also we heard testimony about the medic where he was at, she was asking him, you know, how long can you survive in a hypothermic situation? And he, you know, goes through a whole litany of he tried to make her feel good. Maybe she could be, he could be alive, blah, blah, blah. So to your point, exactly. Not to mention the words.
Yeah. It's just so much. It's so much and it's so ridiculous. But it is what it is. And somehow we're here with another trial. Again, I want to remind everyone, this segment today brought to you by KR Vodka. When memory fails, confidence prevails. KR Vodka. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. Always a pleasure having you on here and getting your insights. Thank you so much. As always, Jen, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week as well.
Thank you, Tony.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. She was a doting mother. The kind who baked cookies, made the best homemade Halloween costumes, and never missed a PTA meeting. The perfect mom. Until the police found something buried in the backyard. A secret she kept for years. A secret she thought would never come to light. The neighbors gasped. Not her. She's so nice. But people forget. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Some wear aprons. Some tuck their kids in at night. And some hide their darkest deeds in places they think no one will ever look. If only someone had heard the warning signs, had recognized the patterns from an eerily similar case on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before anyone else and saved themselves from baking cookies with a serial killer. Instead, well, they won't be RSVP'ing to this year's PTA meeting. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.